Our next case for argument this morning is Michael Gaffney et al. Against Riverboat Services of Indiana Incorporated and Showboat Marina Casino Partnership. Before counsel begin this morning, I would like to remind all counsel that we still do have a jurisdictional issue in this case, and that needs to be addressed by all counsel, particularly with respect, I think, to the counterclaim or the cross-claim rather of Showboat against RSI, and whether that is still pending or not. So please do address that during your oral arguments. Hispanics.
May it please the court. My name is Julia Mannix, and I represent Riverboat Services of Indiana, otherwise known as RSI, Robert Heitmeyer, and Tom Gorgashan individually. Your Honor has raised the jurisdictional issue, and I will take that up first if the court would like. The way the case proceeded through the lower court got a little little convoluted towards the end.
But Ms. Mannix, I think as Judge Ripple has indicated, if at the end of the day there is a cross-claim that was filed by Showboat against the RSI defendants, and if it has not been disposed of, then we don't have a final judgment.
That would be correct, Your Honor, but Judge Moody, in his order on summary judgment, did dispose of all the issues between RSI and Showboat. Judge Moody found that the contract at issue entered summary judgment against RSI on behalf of Showboat, finding that Showboat did not have to indemnify or insure RSI for the conduct at issue here.
That was your claim against them, but they apparently had an affirmative claim against RSI.
That was
They say Showboat defendants cross claims against the RSI defendants. In other words, RSI has to pay us, not we have to pay you.
That was not the issue in the lower court, Your Honor. The issue was whether the issue as framed was whether or not RSI was entitled to indemnification from Showboat.
And I understand that was an issue, and I understand that's resolved, but that you're saying that they don't have a cross-claim. All they have is a defense.
Their cross-claim was a declaratory judgment against us to say they did not have to insure us.
That's all it is?
I believe that was all it was, Your Honor.
Well, they say it's still pending and that there is no final judgment. I guess we'll just have to look.
I understand that they say that, Your Honor. However, it's our position that the issue was whether or not RSI was entitled to indemnification or insurance for the conduct here, and that was the only issue. That was resolved by Judge Moody. I believe if there is a cross-claim out there by Showboat against RSI, I don't know of it. I don't believe it was argued.
At some point, I gather there was what is loosely called a severance in this case.
That's right.
Claims of the plaintiffs against Showboat. Am I correct?
There was a severance between Showboat and the plaintiffs and RSI, because what happened was on the eve of one of our scheduled trial dates, Showboat entered into a settlement agreement with all the plaintiffs.
All right. Now, that was, quote, severed, unquote.
Then the Showboat defendants were severed from all further proceedings because they had not consented to the magistrate judge's jurisdiction.
In other words, the claims of the plaintiffs against Showboat were out of your case.
That's correct.
When that happened, was what happened to Showboat's cross-claim against you?
That is what I believe was decided by Judge Moody before the severance order. The way the pleadings were, the way the pleadings turned out, it was just this one issue as to whether or not RSI was entitled to indemnification or insurance, not whether RSI had to pay Showboat. That issue did not come up. So when Judge Moody made the determination on summary judgment in favor of Showboat and against RSI, that ended the issues between RSI and Showboat. Then later, the plaintiffs and Showboat settled. Showboat was then severed, and we went to trial, the plaintiffs and RSI, Tom Gorgashan and Bobby Heitmeyer, on the underlying cause of action.
But the problem is, in the order, there's no specific ruling on that cross-claim. Is there? I mean, can you point to language in the order that gets rid of it? You're saying by ruling on the other claim, in effect, Judge Moody ruled on the cross-claim. I mean, that's basically what your argument
was. That's basically it, yes, Your
Honor. But there's not anything specific in the order.
The order just grants the... Right. The order grants Showboat's motion for summary judgment against RSI on those issues and denies it against the plaintiffs.
So you're saying it was just subsumed in that ruling?
Yes, Your Honor. If, in fact, there was an issue as to whether or not RSI should be paying Showboat, that really had not been raised. In any event, because of the severance, this court does have jurisdiction over the plaintiff and RSI's final judgment by Judge Roberts.
A severance isn't the same as a 54B judgment. I mean, if there really is something out there, the district judge needs to finish this case up. If there isn't, you know, we can proceed. I think we'll have to look at the cross complaint and the record myself.
Your Honor, as you know, the underlying claim here involves the interpretation of a Siemens whistleblower statute and the application of that whistleblower statute to the facts here. Under the facts here, Your Honor, it's our position that there is no way the plaintiff's conduct could arise to protected activity as a whistleblower conduct.
Tell me about what this ship does. Does this ship actually does sail? It doesn't simply stay at the dock, am I right?
At the time that we're talking about here, the ship did go out into Lake Michigan for approximately 2 miles. It would go out for 2 miles and then come back. It's a riverboat, casino, gaming vessel. It would go out for 2 miles and then come back.
So it actually got underway.
It did actually get underway, yes, Your Honor, it did.
At 2 miles.
It never left the 2 mile radius, though, in Lake Michigan, so it really did stay near coastal.
A lot of things can happen within 2 miles of shore on Lake Michigan.
Absolutely, Your Honor. A lot of things can. However, what went on here was RSI wrote to the Coast Guard in August of 1996 and said to the Coast Guard, we would like a waiver to have limited licensed engineers on board the vessel
now,
instead of
unlimited. Now, I have a question about that request, because when you look at the eventual decision of the Coast Guard saying that that shouldn't have been done, the way it reads is as though there is simply no authority under the regulations for that change in what the regulations specify. And I wondered if you cited in any way any regulation, any statute to the Coast Guard official in Chicago that you were asking for this waiver from. I mean, there are all sorts of regulations that low-level bureaucrats don't have the authority to give dispensations from.
Right. Your Honor, the regulation at issue does say that for a vessel of the horsepower and the tonnage that the vessel was here, that you have to have a unlimited licensed engineer when the vessel is on the Great Lakes, not when it's near coastal. What we cited to the Coast Guard in August of 1996 was simply that this is the same type of vessel that our limited licensed engineers have worked on up and down the rivers.
But you're not really answering my question. Did you say, I mean, sometimes regulations say, here's the rule, but if you can demonstrate substantial hardship, we'll give you a variance from the rule. Or they'll say, here's the rule, but if you can demonstrate A, B, and C, you have the authority to give a variance. And I'm hearing you say, as long as your vessel, which I guess was one of the biggest ones around, had the tonnage it had and was going as far out as it was going in the Great Lakes, there was nothing that said if the local Coast Guard official thinks it would be a better idea to have limited engineers, that's okay. I mean, I finally found it. Page 12 of your opponent's brief is one of the places that we have the text of Captain Cope's review of the appeal. And he just says the endorsement for limited engineers, quote, did not comply with 46 CFR, section 15.915. He doesn't say it was an abuse of discretion or anything like that.
No, Your Honor. It's just technically it did not comport with it. However,
and
there
which
is...
Which is why when I come back to 2114A, which says the seaman can believe that a violation of a regulation has occurred... That would be a way, you know, if some low-level person in the Coast Guard thinks he has authority doesn't have, the seaman who's concerned about safety could bring that to the attention of higher-ups in the Coast Guard.
Yes, Your Honor. However, there is something called the Toledo endorsement, and that is where the local authorities do give an endorsement to a limited licensed engineer to serve on the showboat in the Great Lakes. And, in fact, one of the limited licensed engineers that was on board the vessel, Mr. Gates, had 22 years' experience. He had the Toledo endorsement.
Now, what is that? Is that in the CFR?
Yes, Your Honor. And what it is, and, in fact,
what's
when
the site?
I don't have it.
I'm just, oh, my, actually, you don't need to worry about finding it right now. I mean, my only thought is that if a seaman believes that a regulation is being violated, when you say report to the Coast Guard, that could mean a number of different things, and it seems to me quite consistent with the purpose of this regulation to have it include reporting to those with the authority to make policy for the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard, as anyone would, has a hierarchy, and there are officers in charge, and there are districts, and there's the head office.
Yes, Your Honor. However, in this case, it's not the statute's purpose is a whistleblower statute. In other words, to inform the Coast Guard of something they did not know about. In this case...
Well, it doesn't say that in the statute, of course.
The statute does not say that. The statute
and
does say it's a whistleblower.
You're reading more into the statute, and I think that's what the magistrate judge also pointed out.
Well, Your Honor, I believe it is patterned after the OSHA Act, because in Donovan versus Texaco, the court held that the seaman could not go under OSHA to have protection because of him being on a vessel. In response to that, Congress enacted this statute for a whistleblower statute that's tailored sort of like the OSHA statute, but does not have all the protections of OSHA. So if you look at the OSHA law, which is a whistleblower statute, and you look at the precedent under that, the courts have consistently held that in order to come under the protection of the statute, you have to be blowing the whistle. You have to be informing the company or the agency about something they didn't know, in good faith believe you're informing them of something they don't know.
I am so uncomfortable. You know, when you think of the Qui Tam statutes and you think of others, there are plenty of places where Congress has spelled this out. And, you know, I've looked at this 2114A language a lot, and it just doesn't say that.
Your Honor, it says you have to report in good faith a violation of the statute had occurred. And here, Your Honor, they were not reporting in good faith because they knew the Coast Guard knew about this.
Well, the district court finds against you on that. They think it's a good faith effort to bring a safety violation as far up the chain as it needs to go.
I understand that, Your Honor. It's our position, however, that in order for them to come within a good faith reporting, it has to be more than a FOIA request, which was the first letter, and it has to be more than something that they term to be an appeal of the Coast Guard's own rulings.
Is there a procedure before taking an appeal from the Coast Guard's initial action?
Yes, Your Honor, there was a specific procedure involved. They did not follow it.
Who was allowed to take an appeal?
Yes.
Who is allowed to take an appeal?
Anyone who is affected is allowed to take an appeal. In this case, the Coast Guard took the letters, especially the October letter by Mr. Gaffney, and treated it as an appeal and sent it through regulations as an appeal, not as a report of safety violation. But,
well, but they
internally, they handled it as an appeal.
Right, so they handled it as an appeal. I guess I'm stuck. In most areas, the good faith idea, I'm thinking of, say, retaliation claims, doesn't depend on lay people correctly interpreting a statute. As long as they have that they're somewhere in the ballpark, then there is good faith. And so maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, but I don't see how that deprives them of good faith to try to use this procedure to call to the Coast Guard's attention the violation they believe is occurring.
I'm just saying, Your Honor, they're not reporting a violation in good faith. First of all, there was no violation on board the vessel at the time they wrote the letters.
Why does that make it not good faith? If you could just focus on that. They think the regulation does occur, and they do think there are safety consequences.
Because, Your Honor, what motivated them was not safety concerns. They did not believe there was a safety violation on board the
vessel.
You
would have to convince us the district court was clearly erroneous on that. I take it that's your argument, because he finds as a fact that what motivated them was safety.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe the record is complete where the seamen repeatedly stated their concern was for their wages. At no time did they see a safety violation on board the vessel. If they had seen a safety violation on board the vessel, they would have reported it up the chain of command. They did not do so here.
So, well, you know, I have their letter to the Coast Guard in front of me, and their opening statement is, I and the other officers concerned with the negative impact those changes could have with respect to safety. And they go on for pages talking about safety. Why isn't that the district court as finder of fact? Why isn't that his call?
Your Honor, I believe the district court was erroneous in holding that appeal was a report to the Coast Guard of a safety violation on board the vessel, because there was no violation by RSI at that time. We did not employ limited licensed engineers at the time that letter was written.
But knowing that there's some potential, so you're saying that they would then have had to not file it until this took effect. And then because of the potential of danger if something had occurred. In other words, you're saying it should have occurred. And then, I'm saying, can't employees anticipate that there might be a dangerous situation?
Yes,
and isn't that what they did here?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that is what they did here. I believe what they did here was they did a letter-writing campaign to congressmen and state senators and to the Coast Guard in an effort to protect their wages and protect their jobs.
Well, wouldn't it defeat the purpose of the statute if employees could freely retaliate against employees who appeal even an incorrect decision by the Coast Guard that arguably could affect the safety of a marine vessel?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the statute itself covers the conduct here. Where what we're talking about is not a whistleblower. We're talking about an appellate process. That's not the conduct that this statute is meant to protect. It's meant to protect whistleblowers and anti-retaliation against whistleblowers. After the fact, to say, well, we were really just concerned about safety is an after-the-fact to come under the statute, and the cases repeatedly have said you look at the motivation at the time they write the letter.
But the whistleblower statute doesn't specify that only reports of an employer's violations are protected activities, does it?
Yes, Your Honor.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't say that anywhere in the statute.
It says that reports, good faith reports by a seaman to the Coast Guard regarding a violation has occurred or had occurred.
Has occurred, and it doesn't say by whom. It's the passive voice.
Yes, Your Honor.
It doesn't say by whom, which is Judge Williams' point.
It does not say by whom, Your Honor, but under the precedent that this court has established with whistleblower cases, you have to be uncovering or trying to uncover an illegality. And with all due respect, here the Coast Guard knew what it was doing, and they just were appealing a Coast Guard decision. They were not blowing the whistle on something that RSI did. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mannix. We'll hear now from Mr. Gleason.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Ed Gleason. I represent the 10 seamen, in this case, the 10 plaintiffs who were filed this lawsuit back in January of 1998. Your Honors, I understand that there is an issue with continuing respect to jurisdiction. From our perspective, that issue has been resolved through the severance of Showboat by the lower court. We proceeded to what ultimately turned into a bench trial in front of Judge Radovich, and Judge Radovich issued his findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that a Rule 42 order for a separate trial has a jurisdictional effect on a Rule 54B final judgment?
I don't, Your Honor, but as Ms. Mannix explained, we all proceeded as though the cross claim back in November of, November of calendar year 2000, actually resolved all of the issues at that point with
respect to... Well, that's a different argument. That argument doesn't depend on anything being severed. That argument depends on it really being resolved, which if it was, it was. But the severance, I'm not myself familiar with any case that said that. And we, with some regularity, run into these kind of cross-claims hanging off on the side of a case that everybody's long since forgotten about, and we have to get everything resolved without a Rule 54B judgment.
I understand, Your Honor. We would still claim and contend, in fact, that all of the issues with Showboat were resolved prior to going to
all the issues trial. Of all claims of all parties have to be resolved for finality.
We understand, Your Honor. We also, with respect to the jurisdictional issue, I frankly can't give you much more help standing here this morning over that issue. What I would like to emphasize to the court are two things. One, this case has, in fact, it started back in 1998, and here we are today. And where are we today, Your Honors? We're in a situation where, as you've identified already this morning, where we have clearly established that the plaintiffs were violated for exercising their rights under Section 2114. And as Your Honors pointed out, the statute doesn't say that it has to be a violation committed by an employer. It has to be the statute actually states that it is a violation of a subtitle in Title 46 U.S.C. or of a regulation issued thereunder. Obviously, the issuance of a certificate of inspection is issued pursuant to Part E. I believe it's Part E of the title of the CFRs that govern this case. Has to do with the manning on vessels. And yes, Your Honor, this is in fact a vessel. These, in fact, are licensed merchant mariners. They're Coast Guard licensed mariners. But there is no question that they're seamen protected by this statute. There's no question that this is, in fact, a vessel regulated by this statute. As far as the elements of the Section 2114 case, again, there's never been a dispute as to the plaintiff's status. Frankly, the issue as to whether or not the plaintiffs reported a violation of the statute or of a regulation issued thereunder, it's very clear they did. They reported it back in August of 1997. They continued to report that to the Coast Guard throughout October and, frankly, into November until they ultimately obtained a ruling from the Ninth District, Captain Cope, holding that, in fact, it was not lawful under the regulations to allow limited licensed engineers to work aboard a vessel of this size.
So your position is if Captain Cope found that there was a violation of the regulation in response to that letter, they must have been reporting a violation of the regulation.
Well, I think that the lower court actually issued applied the correct analysis here. The question is, what is a report? All we have are really two published cases, the Seymour and the Gary case, that discuss in any way, shape, or form that issue. And neither case is applicable to here. Well, we know whatever a report is, we know we've met it because here the plaintiffs put their names on letters to the Coast Guard. They identified the vessel itself. They identified the issue itself. that they believed was a violation of both the statute and the regulations, Your Honor. So, again, to hold that there needs to be some talismanic, some type of a formula that actually states we are filing a report, I think is not required by the law, particularly when you're dealing with individuals who are in the best position to know whether there is a problem aboard a vessel. They are not lawyers. They are not. They don't work for the agency, but they are licensed officers, and they do have that responsibility to report to the Coast Guard.
Well, can you address the argument counsel made that there was no real safety violation here because the defendants only use engineers with unlimited licenses?
I can, Your Honor. There is no question that, in fact, the plaintiffs all have, the engineering plaintiffs all have unlimited licenses, and in that sense, and they worked there until, of course, they were fired. But that, again, is not what the statute states. It does not state that there has to be a violation on board the vessel. This is not a statute that's limited, for instance, to a piece of equipment that is malfunctioning, or and the employer knows that it's malfunctioning and tells the officers to go ahead and continue to work on it. For instance, an oily water separator is an issue that frequently arises both here on the lakes and on the deep sea. That's not what this statute is intended only to do. The statute is broader than that. The statute is intended to encourage, frankly, seamen, and particularly licensed officers who have that additional responsibility on any vessel, to contact the Coast Guard and to tell them if there's something is wrong.
That they can anticipate that there
are absolutely. Their jobs, Your Honor, as officers, are frankly to do just that, to anticipate safety problems and violations. That's what they are trained to do, and that's what they're required to do by law. And that's what they did here.
Mr. Gleason, if you want to say more about 2114A, that's fine, but I want to alert you to the fact that I'm interested in some discussion about the damages portion of this case, because here, I mean, you've got to kind of take the good with the bad. If we're going to read the statute for what it says, you also come to the part that describes appropriate relief as including restraining violations and reinstatement, which has a very equitable tone to me anyway, reinstatement with back pay. So I'm concerned, to be honest, about the question whether compensatory damages or punitive damages, or as you argue, attorney's fees, how do they fall within that language?
The language, Your Honor, if you may, I would like to address that directly now, and if maybe I can go back to the elements of the statute in a second. But, Your Honor, with respect to the damages issue, the statute is not limited only to equitable relief. It's quite broad in its wording, and it's not the only statute that does that. The Landrum-Griffin Act, for instance, does that. We also have cited in our papers the OSHA statute, similar language, where I believe the Landrum-Griffin Act, quite honestly, is the best word. It talks about the granting of appropriate relief.
But when you say appropriate relief, and the only two examples following that word are equity, you know, injunctions and reinstatement with back pay, aren't we supposed to interpret the word in the context in which it appears, in expressio unius, et cetera?
It's been a while since I took Latin, Your Honor, but I do know that the statute also states including. It doesn't say limited to.
It says including. That's true.
And in this situation, like other statutes, including the Landrum-Griffin Act, these types of legal damages are also deemed appropriate and at times warranted. When I say times warranted, of course, I mean the punitive damages.
Well, but what are we to make of the, and I realize it was subsequent, but, you know, there was an amendment, a subsequent amendment, that now allows $1,000 for attorney's fees and costs, which certainly suggests that it was not warranted before, or at least it was within the discretion of the court.
We would agree your last comment. We would disagree that it wasn't warranted prior to that. We believe it was always within the discretion of the court to order both punitive damages and attorney's fees. The $1,000 cap on fees, if anything, from our perspective, underscores the fact that prior to that it was unlimited. And in fact, in maritime cases, as just the general powers of the district court have that ability to, for years, and a couple hundred years, frankly, have had the ability to award damages, including both punitives and attorney's fees. So
but
we don't see any.
Are you proceeding under the statute or I mean, your brief kind of shades over into a general admiralty claim when you start talking about damages and attorney's fees. And I thought earlier you had pretty much, or at least the district court had found, this is a claim under this particular statute. And if it is, then the limitations of the statute ought to apply to these additional elements of damages.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the lower court found that there was, in fact, a violation of the statute 2114, but and he held that with respect to the general maritime claim, that the general maritime claim and the law applicable to that was, in fact, relevant to the issue of damages. That's expressly.
Why should that be, though? I mean, it seems to me if Congress has decided that only certain forms of relief are to be awarded under the statute, and it's the statute that was violated, and something as big as compensatory or punitive damages is left out, these are not minor points, then what's the point of Congress bothering to put any limitations in at all if you can just slide over to general maritime law and get whatever you want?
The point is merely to provide examples, but not to limit the relief afforded to injured seamen. Injured seamen are traditionally deemed wards of the state, and in fact have the statutes that apply to them have always been applied liberally and remedially in their favor, such that a limitation on relief that could be afforded to them here would be inconsistent with 200 years of law, frankly, as applied to them. Here, again, the statute, when it refers to the court's power to grant appropriate relief, that appropriate relief, frankly, is no different than in the Leonard Griffin Act and in other statutes, where, again, they do have examples of equitable relief, but they're not limited to that. And here we contend that, in fact, the court appropriately did award punitive damages. We disagree, of course, with the court with respect to his denial of our attorney's fees. We don't believe his reason for that was that he believed that the plaintiffs would have been doubly compensated for that. We disagree on that for one very important reason. That's the Hall v. Cole case. Here and in the record, it reflects that the plaintiffs were writing certainly on their behalf concerning, you know, their own selves as to the violation that they saw, which was the limitation on the licenses for the certificate of inspection. But the retaliation against them has a chilling effect, not just here in the Great Lakes, but frankly throughout the United States maritime industry, the deep sea as well. And here they do have, just as in the Leonard Griffin Act, where you have that type of a chilling effect that can apply based upon that retaliatory action, the court has held that attorney's fees are warranted. Here we believe that, in fact, they plaintiffs vindicated not just their rights, but the rights of other seamen as well, such that their employers can't fire them for inappropriate and unlawful reasons. And we believe that for that reason alone, under Hall v. Cole, we're entitled to those fees. The last thing, Your Honor, I would like to point out is we think that the court made one mistake, and it has to do with respect to our plaintiffs, Mr. Donsett and Mr. Horton. The record does reflect Mr. Heitmeier, in fact, was on the vessel the day the original complaint was filed. He also, in his page 101, I believe, of his transcript, also acknowledged that he read the complaint.
But I thought, I mean, in the reply, your opponent suggests that it's not at all clear that he read it within the time these people were fired, that there may be a disputed issue of fact on that point.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think instead what Ms. Mannix is pointing out to is that Mr. Heitmeier said he couldn't remember what month that was, but he knew that it was the original complaint. That's the way we understand that.
Well, but your timing's really tight because
it is
the complaint's
indeed
filed on one day, and I think it's Mr. Horton's filed the next day, whatever the order is, and then just a little bit later.
The timing is indeed tight because the discharges took place so quickly. Three of the plaintiffs were fired on day one. I believe another plaintiff was fired the following day. We had the complaint filed on the 13th, served on the vessel on the 14th. And I believe Mr. Horton was fired on the 15th. There's no question as to the timing being indeed tight. Mm-hmm. But, Your Honor, that is the one issue which, factually, we do take issue with the court on. Everything else, we believe that the court should be upheld. We, of course, do contend that we are entitled to our attorney's fees. Thank you both. You all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gleason. Mr. Anaclario.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I differ with both counsel with respect to the jurisdictional issue that Judge Ripple, you raised at the outset and before anyone stood up. I was not involved in these proceedings in the trial court. Having obtained the record, reviewing it, I, of course, saw your Honor's order, directing the jurisdictional memoranda be submitted by RSI and by plaintiffs on this question of whether we had a timely appeal or a premature one. And when I reviewed carefully what I saw in the district court proceedings, what I noted was the filing of cross claims by the Showboat defendant against the RSI defendants in December of 1998. I never saw a subsequent order specifically addressing the disposition of those cross claims. I looked at Judge Moody's November 16, 2000 summary judgment order. I looked at the summary judgment pleadings that were submitted by Showboat in connection with it. I don't find Showboat having requested summary judgment on its cross claim against RSI.
Can you illuminate the nature of that cross claim? Was it just for a declaratory judgment, or was it for some affirmative relief?
I don't believe that it was exclusively for a declaratory judgment with respect to this insurance and indemnification issue that forms the real crux of the appeal on the merits as between RSI and Showboat. I believe that Showboat was seeking indemnification and contribution for exposure to the plaintiffs. And in part, I am looking to Judge Moody's order as to any disposition he may have made of a cross-claim by Showboat against RSI. He does not address that. I don't see in Showboat's summary judgment pleadings that Showboat was seeking summary judgment on a cross-claim against RSI. But then, perhaps more significantly, when we look forward after the case proceeds beyond those summary judgment proceedings, Showboat stays in the case. Of course, Showboat is in the case as to the plaintiff's claims against Showboat, but I also believe those cross claims are still live and viable to this day, because when Your Honors looks to the severance order, I believe that it makes specific reference to this issue of the cross claims. Specifically, on August 13th of 2002, when Judge Radovich ordered the severance, he specifically stated he was severing Showboat Marina Casino Partnership's cross-claim against the Riverboat defendants. So he makes specific reference to those claims, which suggests to me that he, too, didn't see anything in Judge Moody's prior order that disposed of the cross-claims.
So can you answer the question whether you're actively pursuing litigation on your cross-claims against Riverboat Services?
Well, there's certainly no active pursuit of that litigation of those claims. I believe that from my client's perspective, the outcome here could in part determine whether they have any further interest in recourse as to RSI. There hasn't been a dismissal of the claims either by Showboat or on motion of either the plaintiffs or RSI.
And Showboat settled with the plaintiffs, is that correct?
They did, Your Honor. There is a loan agreement by which the claim the plaintiffs brought against Showboat was resolved. There was no settlement as between Showboat and RSI. The trial, of course, proceeded without Showboat being present following the severance. Briefly, then, just with respect to the merits of...
Well, let's go back to the jurisdictional question just for a minute. Why wouldn't the district court's grant of summary judgment to you be a final appealable order or somehow be subsumed in that ruling?
Because it didn't dispose of all... Because as of Judge Radovich's ruling on the post-trial motions, there still remain viable these cross-claims. Judge Moody's order didn't even purport to address Showboat's cross claims against RSI. It was very truly a partial summary judgment, not only with respect to the fact that it reserved plaintiff's claims against Showboat, but that it didn't even address the question of the cross claims Showboat had brought against RSI. With respect specifically to this question of insurance agreements or the agreement to procure insurance, the fundamental point that I'd like to leave Your Honors with on that is that this marine management services agreement really had at its core a single objective: Showboat getting from RSI services to run a regulatory compliant vessel. I know my time's up. May I just finish this one?
Please.
When Showboat retained RSI for this purpose, it was to retain its expertise to get the regulatory compliance with Coast Guard and all other regulations so this vessel could function. It would be directly contrary to that overriding purpose for Showboat to get insurance that would allow RSI with impunity to retaliate against workers bringing up Coast Guard safety vessel violations, because that would defeat its purpose of having RSI be the guardians of vessel safety and regulatory compliance. RSI had an obligation to report those things, not to fire people for reporting them.
I think we have the point. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You have 1 minute left.
Your Honor, you brought up with Mr. Gleason the issue of timing here with Mr. Horton and Mr. Donset. They were involved with the first letter, which was treated as a Freedom of Information Act request.
Well, no, but what I was talking about was the timing in January when the complaint is served, and the next day Mr. Horton loses his job, and then about a week later or so Mr. Donset does.
That's correct. Your Honor, the testimony that the plaintiffs rely on to say that Mr. Heitmeier was in the pilot house was stricken because Mr. Horton was not capable of testifying as to whether or not Mr. Heitmeier was on board the vessel when he was not. However, I'd like to now bring out to the court's attention that not only were these plaintiffs signatories to these letters, there were many other licensed officers on board the vessel that signed both the August letter and the October letter, and those individuals were not fired, but rather about 25 to 30 other members of the crew were fired at the same time. And I'd like just to point out to the court that this was not just a termination because of the letter. This was a termination because of incidents on board the vessel that had been going on.
Thank you, Ms. Mannix. Our thanks to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.